Hello, I'm Nick Clark. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, the US is facing a fiscal standoff that could put the nation at risk of defaulting on its debt for the first time ever. So, what's behind America's debt ceiling crisis? And should the rest of the world be worried? Also this week, it's seen as Britain's national treasure, but the country's health service system is falling apart. So how did the NHS reach this point? And is there a way out of the crisis? Plus, the travel and tourism industry is picking up speed this year. The travellers' tastes are changing, and they're increasingly going green. So, the US debt is now six times what it was at the start of this century. Despite its growing liabilities, the country has never defaulted on its payments. Now the US has crashed through its $31.4 trillion borrowing limit, and that means the government could run out of cash to pay its bills in less than 5 months, and puts Congress on the clock to raise or suspend the debt ceiling. But getting lawmakers to agree on that is expected to be a tough political battle on Capitol Hill. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives refuses to raise the debt limit unless President Joe Biden agrees to steep spending cuts. Democrats want it to be raised without any conditions. The Treasury Department has started taking so-called extraordinary measures, including suspending investments for retirees, to avoid missing financial obligations to bondholders. But that would give Congress and Biden until early June to resolve the issue. Well, the United States is among a few countries to set a legal limit on borrowing. So what exactly is the debt ceiling? It's the maximum amount the government can borrow to pay bills already approved by lawmakers. It doesn't include new spending commitments. The measure was first introduced back in 1917 to make it easier for the government to finance its participation in the First World War. It has been periodically raised because the US runs large annual deficits and the revenue it collects isn't sufficient. The nation's debt is currently at more than 120% of GDP, but that's still lower than more than a dozen countries, including Japan, Greece, and Italy. In recent years, with the US becoming more partisan, lawmakers have used the debt ceiling vote as leverage against other issues. Indeed, a standoff over the debt ceiling in 2011 led Standard & Poor's to cut the US's credit rating for the first time ever. Well, to discuss all of that, I'm joined now from London by Richard Siegel. Richard's a research analyst at Ambrosia Capital. Welcome to the programme, sir. So, first up, I think it's worth repeating, isn't it? The US debt six times what it was at the start of the century. How come?
Well, there are a number of different reasons. There's natural growth in debt anyway, with the economy growing and spending growing and with inflation and the like. But I think the problems really go to the early part of the 2000s when fiscal discipline was lost after the end of the dot-com crisis. And then things really got bad in the last Republican administration when there were some major tax cuts, and things got even worse at the beginning of the last administration, both because of pandemic-related spending and also because of tax cuts. The difference between the Republican tax cuts and the Democratic tax cuts is that the first were corporate-oriented and the second were individual-oriented.
All right,
in the form of rebates.
So we are where we are now. And if the debt limit is not raised, basically the federal government just runs out of cash, right?
Yes, that's correct. There's a very arcane calculation which determines the debt limit. You really do have to be a specialist in order to understand it. But at a certain point, the U.S. government can no longer borrow, and therefore, technically, it would go into default. Because the consequences would be so devastating, it's pretty likely that an agreement would be reached, even if it's very painful and even if it's at the very last minute.
Why does it have to be painful? Why does it have to be the last minute? Why not just raise the debt ceiling?
It's politics. It has happened many times over the past 15, 20 years. In fact, the debt limit law itself dates to 1917. It doesn't really make any economic sense. Maybe it makes some economic sense, but it's just something that there's never been enough political will to do away with.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, has introduced so-called extraordinary measures, I think, to buy time. How costly are these to ordinary Americans, and what kind of things are we talking about?
They're called extraordinary, but in fact, they're really just accounting techniques. The U.S. government issues a lot of debt to Social Security funds and the like, which are effectively non-marketable in their off-balance sheet. It can effectively borrow from them for 6 to 8 months. It's a very serious situation, but I wouldn't say that any kind of default would be imminent. We have plenty of time in order to solve this.
So we brace ourselves to enter the world of partisan wrangling. What do the Republicans want, and how will compromise be reached?
It will have to be reached eventually. The difficulty right now is that this is not just a battle between the Republicans and the Democrats, but it's also a battle within the within the Republican Party, largely because of the long battle in order for Kevin McCarthy to be nominated as House Speaker. He was required to give some concessions to some of the independent-minded congressmen, and they are the ones that are holding out against the Republican Party. So it's not just the typical Republican versus Democratic struggle.
But what is it on the whole that the Republicans want?
Well, what they want is some concessions in terms of lower spending, which would, as one would expect, lower spending on districts that would be of benefit to the Democratic voters, or perhaps in some of the swing states, as we call them. What the independent-minded Republicans would like is lower spending as a whole, which wouldn't be realistic and wouldn't be a good idea. Perhaps the pace of spending increase should be lower, but you wouldn't want to spend too much less when the economy is already very weak.
You say there's no appetite for abolishing the debt limit, but it sounds like that's exactly what should be done, given the wrangling that seems to happen all the time over this. Why is there no political appetite?
It's difficult to tell. It's just one of these things that always falls by the wayside. Other priorities tend to become more important. And because it's been in place for such a long time, more than a century, it just builds its own inertia. It has actually been beneficial sometimes in the past, for example, in the mid-1990s, when it encouraged fiscal discipline in a bipartisan manner, but that didn't last very long. A crisis happens or something else becomes their priority and they lose that discipline.
Tell us more about the U.S.'s debt to GDP ratio. Just how does America's debt compare, say, to other countries?
It is very high. It's approaching 140% of GDP. It will decline naturally as some pandemic-related spending declines and because of what we call the inflation tax. But historically, it had been on the order of 70 to 80%. The European limit is 60%. Most countries are above that, but Germany's about 70%. Germany was on the wrong path, but it managed to reduce its debt load even with low growth and low inflation. So it can be done with a political will. It's much higher in countries such as Italy and Japan. However, the distinction there is that there's less private debt and savings rates in both of those countries are very high, and also they have trade surpluses, so they can sustain much higher debt levels. But in the U.S., it's very high, so at some point, something has to be done.
Is a default on debt inevitable if there is no agreement?
If there is, it would be inevitable. However, I think the silver lining is that it would be so devastating that within a day or two, there would be an emergency agreement, even if it's on a bipartisan manner, in order to resolve it, just because there would be a great impact on the U.S. government, but there would be a great impact on the U.S. economy and the rest of the world.
Richard Siegel, appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
For nearly three quarters of a century, the British government has provided mostly free healthcare for all Britons. And the National Health Service has long been the country's most revered institution, in fact, ranking first in a 2016 survey. But the NHS is now at breaking point. Hospitals are running beyond their capacity, ambulance waits are at record highs, and stressed staff are striking over pay and working conditions. Nadine Barber looks at the debate on the future of the system.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Keep our NHS alive.
With strikes spreading and talk of a system on its knees, is Britain's reverence for its National Health Service blocking much-needed reform? Sajid Javid certainly thinks so. The Conservative former Health Secretary and Finance Minister wrote recently the 75-year-old model of the NHS is unsustainable. Javid suggested people could pay for consulting a family doctor and praised Ireland's system, where patients must pay around $81 to access the equivalent of the UK's accident and emergency departments, A&E, unless referred by their doctor.
Now that's the sort of idea most British politicians run away from, because it means scrapping the doctrine that healthcare should be free at the point of need. The Prime Minister has distanced himself from the comments, but Rishi Sunak did, before taking office, talk about issuing fines to NHS patients who miss appointments. He then backtracked.
The opposition Labour Party's also stepped into the debate. Shadow Health Secretary Wes Streeting has suggested the growing waiting lists could be tackled by the NHS sending more patients to private hospitals. Louise Irvine, a retired family doctor and anti-privatisation campaigner, thinks that's a bad idea.
There isn't an infinite pool of doctors and nurses, and a lot of doctors and nurses go to into the private sector because they get paid more. And furthermore, when something goes wrong in the private sector, the patient is then, you know, red-lighted straight into an NHS A&E. Now, what we need is to build up our NHS again.
Louise says she did see real improvements in patient experience in the 2000s under Labour, when annual increases in NHS funding were higher than they are now. Since it was created, spending on the NHS has increased by an average 3.7% per year in real terms. But from 2010 to 2018, when the Conservatives governed in coalition and then on their own, annual NHS funding growth slowed to 1.4%. It's rising more quickly now, but an ageing population and increasing demand for expensive treatments means nobody's noticing.
If we look at the NHS compared to other OECD countries, we have fewer doctors and nurses per head of population, we have fewer hospital beds per head of population, we have lower levels of investment in things like diagnostic equipment. And all those things are not about the way in which the NHS is organised and funded. That's about the fundamental decisions we made about the level of that we want to spend on health in this country.
So the challenge to the politicians is this: dealing with the crises hitting the health service right now, planning for the long term, and avoiding a two-tier system. Nadine Barber for Counting the Cost in London.
Well, let's take this on. Joining me now, also from London, is Sam Timms, who's an economist at the New Economics Foundation think tank. Sam Timms, welcome to the programme. So, the NHS is in crisis. Even the former health secretary, Sajid Javid, says the system is unsustainable. Do you agree with that?
Well, no, I think the funding for the NHS is unsustainable. The model of kind of free at the point of use, funded by general taxation, that works. But kind of over the last 13 years under the austerity policy that we've had, actually we haven't been investing enough in the NHS compared to the need that the country has. Kind of the need for the NHS has grown, but compared to our international peers, our funding into the NHS has fallen far below the average.
Trouble is, if you put more money into the NHS, then don't other services suffer?
No, that's not necessarily true at all, actually, because if you have a healthy workforce, more people can go into work and therefore they aren't necessarily in as much need of social security, and they're able to pay more tax. So at the moment, we've got about 500,000 people that are economically inactive, so kind of not looking for work, 500,000 more compared to before the pandemic. And we've also got about 500,000 people on NHS waiting lists, 500,000 more than before the pandemic. Now, that's not a one-for-one, but actually there will be a large amount of overlap. And by having a healthy population, you can have a healthier economy.
So why have we reached this point? Why is the NHS in such a state?
Well, there are a few different reasons. The funding that I just mentioned is a big issue. Kind of the needs of our country have grown. We have an ageing population. And actually kind of the funding into the NHS hasn't kept up. There's also a major issue of staffing. We've got something like 160,000 vacancies in the NHS. It's about 1 in 10 positions. Part of that is because of pay for NHS staff. There's a reason why nurses are out on strike at the moment. An experienced nurse is actually worse off on their pay than they were about 10 to 15 years ago. And you have nurses going to food banks. That's not a system that is working at all. And a huge amount of that comes down to the lack of pay and public sector pay freezes that we've had over the last 15 years. There's also a major issue to do with social care, which is then having an impact on the NHS as well.
Right. Let's look at funding. There are various ideas floating about out there, including Javid himself, who proposed making NHS patients pay their doctors for doctor's appointments and even A&E, emergency departments, using a kind of means-tested system. And I think I'm right in saying that that works in, to a degree, certainly in Sweden and Ireland.
Realistically, that's not going to work in the UK. First of all, let's not forget that we do pay for the NHS. We pay for it through national insurance and income tax and other forms of taxation. So we are paying for the service that we get. But when you arrive at your GP, at your A&E, it's free at the point of use. If you put a charge on that, well, it's going to deter people from going to these services. That means that when you've got someone that starts to get a bit ill, they're not going to go to the GP. Instead, they're going to wait several weeks longer, possibly months longer, until they're seriously ill. And then they require far more time from the NHS than they would have if the NHS was able to be there right at the start of their illness. There's something here, you mentioned the model a moment ago of the NHS. There's definitely more that the NHS can do around preventative care, about care in the community. But if you impose a charge for people going and trying to ensure that their health stays as good as it can be, we're never going to get close to that form of preventative care.
All right, Sam, so then how do you reform the funding process?
Well, we have to have a frank discussion here in the UK. Right now, we have American-style taxes, or we're trying to get towards there, but with European-style welfare state. So actually, we need to have an honest discussion of how we're paying for the NHS through taxation, who's paying for it. It's well known that kind of non-doms, for example, aren't paying their fair share of tax. Landlords as well aren't paying their fair share of national insurance or capital gains. There are lots of holes in the tax system, which are quite easy wins for a government of any colour to come in and fix. And immediately you could put that money back into the NHS.
Well, what about this idea, finally, of relying on the private sector and hospitals to help rescue the NHS, put forward by the Labour Party?
So maybe as a very short-term plan, this could work, but anything longer than short-term doesn't quite make sense. We have a staffing issue both in the NHS and in social care, where we've also got about 130,000 vacancies. If we kind of rely too much on that private model, staffing within the NHS in particular is going to get even worse, and that means kind of a greater reliance on private healthcare.
All right, well, it's a battle ahead. Sam Timms, appreciate that. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
After 2 years of pandemic disruptions, the travel industry is roaring back this year. Great news for countries that rely on tourism for revenue, but bad news over concerns of rising CO2 emissions on international flights. However, a new report shows there's a shift in travellers' mindsets, and many are now more encouraged to decrease their carbon footprint. More than 60% of travellers surveyed in the report have chosen sustainable options in the last couple of years, and three-quarters of travellers plan to do so in the future. It also found the majority of high-end travellers are willing to pay more money to make their trips more environmentally friendly. The survey was part of a report conducted by the world travel and tourism sector, Trip.com, and the global consultancy firm Deloitte. So let's dig in more into this report with Julia Simpson, the President and Executive Officer at the World Travel and Tourism Council, joining us from London. Julia, welcome. So, 69% of travellers actively seeking more sustainable travel options. What's driving this rise in demand for sustainable travel?
Yes, it's really interesting, and thank you, Nick, for inviting me on from a very chilly London, I have to say. I think after the pandemic, we saw a very big pent-up demand for travel and tourism, and people were looking to get back to nature, looking to get to the great outdoors. And I think it was inevitable, really, after being all cooped up. But I think that also made people have a greater appreciation of nature and the value and the preciousness of travel. So, and apart from that, sustainability has been going up everybody's, personal lists of what they need to achieve this year. You know, how can I be more sustainable in every aspect of my life? But certainly we published a trend report, and the very top item was people saying that they want to travel more responsibly.
So the demand is there. Is the supply, is the travel and tourism industry adapting to this? Are we seeing a rise in eco-friendly hotels and travel destinations?
Absolutely. You know, you're seeing it all over the world. I was talking to a new member of the World Travel and Tourism Council, Bess Weston, and they said, you know, that when they make hotels, they'll often have solar panels associated at the back of the hotel, and that will be powering the hotel. You're seeing hotels around the world wanting to source their food more locally from local suppliers, you know, and that helps build a strong local economy and give seasonal food rather than maybe a great big food fest where there's a lot of food waste. People in hotels now are avoiding the use of plastics. Water in countries where water is very, very scarce. There are some very incredible examples of how people are recycling and reusing water in places like Africa. So yes, very, very much. It's our, you know, it's the top of the agenda for hoteliers globally as well.
Isn't sustainable travel a lot more expensive? And, you know, times are hard.
Yes, it's really interesting because the trends reports that we looked at acknowledge the fact that people are paying, you know, higher inflation. They've got, you know, their living costs are going up. And yet, really interestingly, when it looks at, you know, spend that wouldn't necessarily have to make, people are saying that they want to keep travel top of their list. And again, I think that is very much a reaction after being sort of locked up for 2 to 3 years. You know, China's just reopened and we're seeing the bookings are going off the scale. So, yes, in a way, I'm not at all surprised that people are prioritising travel. And you're talking about, does it affect costs? Interestingly, for hoteliers, for example, to become more efficient in terms of energy use, yes, it does sometimes cost an initial outlay, an initial investment, but once a hotel is set up, it will actually make the hotel cheaper to run.
There is one catch here, isn't there? You have to fly to get to many of these destinations, and flying currently is not sustainable travel.
Well, you know, it was so interesting because I was looking at the other day that when we use the internet now, the use of the internet is now outstripping in terms of the carbon that it produces, because every time we do a search, it fires up great big data centers around the world. And that search now actually means that the carbon produced from that is more than it is in air travel. But having said all that, that's really just to put it into context. It's not about shaming one sector against another sector. We're all in this together, and every human activity from the moment we wake up, or indeed, you know, even if we're lying asleep in bed with the heating on, every human activity has an impact. And flying, and I come from an aviation background, we have been working since the 1970s on trying to find cleaner ways to fly. As you know, jet fuel is a very particular elite type of fuel that the why it's so important is it's so pure is that it doesn't freeze at 30,000 feet. So we've been trying desperately to find alternatives to this. And now the really great news is there is an alternative. It's called sustainable aviation fuel, and the technology exists. And what we need now is the big oil producers, when they're pumping out so much power, to reserve a part of their business to produce sustainable aviation fuel, because the money's there, the technology is there, the government can do it. Because if you think about governments, they put a lot of regulation in to help people move from petrol and diesel cars to electric cars. So they've done it for ground transportation. So all that sort of regulation is readily available to be able to use for aviation as well.
Yeah, it's a question of scaling it up, isn't it? That's the issue, scaling it up to the degree that it's needed.
Yeah.
I just want to move on. Finally, I just want to ask you, given this issue about flying, are more sustainable type holidays being offered that you could take without having to board an aircraft?
Yes, you know, domestic travel around the world really benefited. We all know that, you know, people in the Middle East, they stayed locally, they discovered parts of the Middle East they'd never been before. In the UK, people were, you know, travelling around to cities and towns and the great outdoors that they had never possibly seen before. So I think that desire for domestic travel and understanding your own culture will continue. And people are using the train. But actually, if you look at the numbers that we're looking at, people are booking now well in advance, and they're booking long haul, and they're booking to go on holidays. Actually, the advent of cities and beach holidays are coming back after wanting to be in the great outdoors and not having to be too close to another human being. Now people actually want to get back to see the culture in the cities and relax on the coast.
All fascinating stuff. Appreciate that, Julia Simpson. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything you've seen, you can tweet me at Nick Clark Aljaz. Please use the hashtag AJCTC or just drop us an email. Countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC, and that will take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. So that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Nick Clark. For the whole team here, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is coming up.